Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation entitled Screening for Alzheimer's Disease, Facilitating an Early Diagnosis for Prompt Intervention. I'm Dr. Mark Agronin. I'm a board-certified and licensed geriatric psychiatrist and the chief medical officer of the Frank C. and Lynn Scaduto Mind Institute and Behavioral Health at Miami Jewish Health in Miami, Florida.
And I'm Dr. Steven Scheinthal. I, too, am a board-certified and licensed geriatric psychiatrist, and I'm professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Rowan Virtua School of Osteopathic Medicine, and I'm the chief of psychiatry at Jefferson Health New Jersey, as well as Virtua Our Lady of Lourdes.
Today, we're going to discuss the urgent need for effective diagnostic methods that can detect Alzheimer's disease at an early stage. We'll discuss blood-based biomarkers and other advances that can help screen Alzheimer's disease non-invasively and in early stages of the disease. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Elaine R. Peskin. Elaine is a co-director of the VA Northwest Mental Illness Research, Education, and Clinical Center, and also a Friends of Alzheimer's Disease Research Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So, Steve, obviously, if we're talking about early diagnosis, the question is, to what end? Why? People are worried about this disease. Obviously, so many people think about it. More and more people suspect as they get older. What's the point? What's the benefit of early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease? And I would say for any neurocognitive disorder, for that matter.
I think years ago, there was a lot of fear, right? If I get this diagnosis, it's a death sentence. You know, why do I want to know that now? But I think what we've seen, both in terms of clinical trials and in new products that are coming out, that the earlier you're diagnosed and you know what's going on, the more efficacious these treatments may actually be. I think one of the challenges in the early clinical trials for dementia-related medication was that the question was always, were these patients identified too late to see large impact in the clinical trial? And the hard part's been, A, getting patients who are very early in diagnosis into clinical trials, but in general, getting patients who are recognized and diagnosed early on, period. I think the internet has been really very beneficial in this. I think families are much more sophisticated. I think they're looking up symptomatology much earlier. I think they're getting their loved ones into assessment centers much earlier. And I think we're seeing a very big shift in the severity at which patients are diagnosed. Whereas years ago, we would see people coming in and they were moderate to late stage of disease. I think now we're seeing patients coming in with very early symptomatology. And perhaps we're at a point pharmacologically where we have the ability to have the greatest impact on disease for these patients.
So true. Now with these new approaches to diagnosis, new approaches to treatment, getting in early is critical. No question about it. Other benefits you'd see, because we still don't have effectively a cure for it. Certainly getting people earlier is going to have other impacts as well in their life, on other lives as well. I guess I'd ask you, do you think it can actually make a difference even lacking a cure right now, diagnosing someone early? What else can we do for them at that point?
I think there's a lot that we could always have done, but I think we're more sophisticated in that area as well. And that's long-term planning, not financial planning, which that often implicates, but certainly in terms of financial planning. But in terms of getting systems in place for families maybe to keep their loved ones at home throughout the course of the disease.
That's right. You and I have both seen so many instances in which families just waited too long, and now they're stuck with difficult legal or financial issues or difficult care issues that could have been mitigated if they'd been attended to years before. But if you don't have a diagnosis, there's nothing you can do.
And I think having the diagnosis early not only lets us treat the patient, which is obviously critical, but equally critical but not well discussed is the treatment of the caregiver.
That's such a good point. That's right, because the longer you wait, you see depression, you see hopelessness. That increased burden can take such a terrible toll. And at later stages in life, it can be more difficult to reverse that.
And it's not only the stress, it's the physical health impact that that stress can create on the caregiver. And you and I have both seen instances where the patient affected with the neurocognitive disorder outlives the caregiver because the caregiver never got the attention and the care they needed, and they wind up passing on, leaving someone who is fading.
Yes. Tragically, we see that too many times. Elaine, I'd love to bring you in here because as we're thinking about early diagnosis, we're in a new era now where we have these biomarkers. But before we get to biomarkers, you know, maybe you can describe our current understanding of the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease and how that understanding lends itself to the concept of a biomarker.
Sure. And, you know, most of the most used biomarkers and now FDA-approved biomarkers really focus on the two hallmark pathologies of Alzheimer's that were discovered by Dr. Alzheimer in the early 1900s, amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Amyloid plaques are extracellular collections of amyloid, mostly in its 42 amino acid length, along with other proteins, and they're sticky, so lots of things stick to them. And neurofibrillary tangles are collections of abnormally phosphorylated version of a normal cytoskeletal protein tau that occurs within neurons and eventually kills neurons. But there are all kinds of other pathologies as well that may lend themselves to biomarkers, and biomarkers for all of them are in development. And those include astrocytic activation, microglial activation, other inflammatory markers, both presynaptic and postsynaptic damage, and just neuronal injury in general. So there are lots of other potential approaches, but the best developed are markers for amyloid and tau in various forms.
When someone comes to you with concerns that they have neurocognitive changes, how do you work them up? What's your standard of care in terms of that?
Well, the first thing, you know, the most important single ingredient is a careful clinical history from someone who knows the patient well, usually the spouse or an adult child. And, you know, I'm kind of not a big believer in extensive neuropsych testing. I think everyday life is the ultimate cognitive test. So I think a careful clinical history, what is the person having trouble with? You know, what is the nature of the memory problems and other cognitive problems? That's, to me, the most important ingredient. Of course, we do the standard workup to rule out other causes, potential causes of cognitive impairment and decline. The rare event where you have a person who has a common disorder in late life, like vitamin B12 deficiency or hypothyroidism, but rarely does correcting them actually reverse dementia. Obviously, they can cause excess disability. And then I believe every patient getting the workup for Alzheimer's disease needs a neuroimaging study, usually an MRI without contrast. And again, to mostly rule out other causes of cognitive impairment. And that's really been the, until fairly recently, has been the backbone of the workup of Alzheimer's. And, you know, of course, a careful physical and neurologic exam. But now we actually have biomarkers, biofluid biomarkers, as well as imaging biomarkers that work and work very well. Would you like me just to talk about that? I'll let you ask me a more specific question.
Sure. And as you were saying this, and Steve, I wanted to ask you that when we have someone in the office, we can do these things, which is great. But part of our work has to be to get out in the community and get people educated and screened for this. And I was going to ask about, you know, if you've been involved with the different initiatives screening people and what your approach to be to screen someone in the community would before they come in for something more comprehensive.
So I haven't been involved in any specific programs, but often get involved in being asked to screen people in the community. And it's, I find that sometimes it's very cumbersome because it may be a friend or not a close family member that is asking for this type of intervention, and you just get total resistance. And I've, in my area, I find that it's easier to bring them in because they've at least agreed to participate. But I actually had a question for Elaine because, you know, it's doing the biomarkers and doing the neuroimaging, I agree with you, and so critical. But how do you handle people with financial limitations or financial instability who maybe are resistant to getting neuroimaging or testing because they're afraid of coverage issues or, you know, really are just suspicious of the medical community in general, and so they don't want anything more than maybe an office visit and some light paper and pencil testing?
Well, I can tell you that for a 10-year period at it, when I was a director of the clinical core of the University of Washington Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the associate director of the center, that we didn't use any kind of biomarker, no APOE genotyping, no fluid biomarkers, no imaging. And we were able to correctly diagnose Alzheimer's, confirmed on autopsy 97% of the time in a 10-year period. That isn't to say they didn't have additional concomitant pathologies. But I think a clinical diagnosis, again, that careful clinical history, you know, the vast majority of persons who are having memory problems, you know, characterized by, you know, problems with recent memory, maybe some executive function problems. They have a normal neuro exam except for the cognitive parts. The vast majority of those will have Alzheimer's disease. Myself, I don't think it's a difficult clinical diagnosis to make. Obviously, I'm an expert, as are you two, but there are lots of people who get this care in primary care and may not have an expert clinical diagnostician. And that's where biomarkers and imaging become, you know, specific imaging for Alzheimer's become very important.
It's such a good point. And Steve and I have talked about that throughout this entire series, that it's important to get expert opinions here. Obviously, most of the time, individuals end up in the office of their primary care physician, and that's where they should go first. But you know, just as if you're dealing with a complicated cardiac issue, you're going to go to a cardiologist or a specialist. People need to get to neurologists and geriatric psychiatrists who really specialize in this area. So it's such a good point. You alluded to genetics, and I want to ask about what sort of genetic testing you incorporate into, you know, standard workup, and what do you think is even relevant there? Does it make a difference?
Well, as you know, a very small percentage of Alzheimer's patients belong to families in which this is Alzheimer's is a genetic disease, and with an autosomal dominant mode of transmission, meaning you have to have a single parent who has the gene to be affected. Most of these are late onset Alzheimer's disease families for which we have no identified mutations that we can diagnose. There are three mutations for early onset Alzheimer's disease. And when I say early onset, I mean really early. The youngest patient I ever treated got Alzheimer's disease the year he turned 30. But it's usually onset in the early 40s for the presenilin 1 mutations. It's a little more variable for the presenilin 2 mutations and for the amyloid precursor protein mutations. But in these early onset families, who want to know if they have a mutation, genetic testing is available. And, you know, it's you know, often been a very sad thing to take care of these patients because they often, you know, as opposed to Alzheimer's patients in generally who more often than not have poor insight, patients in these families often have good insight. And they're not only aware that, you know, they've had a parent with Alzheimer's disease, they're aware of what their future is going to bring. They're aware they have a 50-50 shot of having given it, the gene to their children. often is associated with really, really hard to treat depression, and you know, and it's very existential type depression, and you know, it's just sad, but these are, you know, and those families again with early onset Alzheimer's, usually in the early 40s, these are diagnosable mutations. Beyond that, the biggest sort of genetic factor in most of Alzheimer's disease is the apolipoprotein E gene. Apolipoprotein E is a cholesterol transport protein. It comes in three alleles or flavors, the 2, 3, and 4. And it's been shown that if you have a 4, you know, of course, you get one copy of the gene from one from your mother and one from your father, so you have two copies. And it's been shown that if you have a 4 allele, especially if both your alleles are 4, you have an increased risk of Alzheimer's. That, and it's really an accelerated time of getting disease. So that's another, that, and that plays the biggest role in Alzheimer's. And the likelihood of having the E4 allele in the general population is about 25%. But in Alzheimer's centers, in patients who have Alzheimer's disease, the allele frequency is more like 60%. And in people who have a presenilin-1 mutation, we've seen it's as high as 90%.
Do you routinely test for ApoE in patients?
We don't because, you know, and, you know, I've done 23andMe. I could know my ApoE4 genotype. I'd opted out because we really don't have anything we can do about it. So to me, why would I want to know? I've seen many people who do want to know, and I can understand, you know, your choice about it, but that wasn't my choice.
So Elaine, do you ever get worried about the ethics on the gene testing and who can get a hold of that information and what the consequence of that information could be?
Well, now, you know, we have laws that having your genetic information, you cannot, you know, it cannot affect your health insurance. Whether it affects your ability to get long-term care or life insurance is probably a different story. So, of course, but, you know, every effort and, you know, is made to keep this information confidential with the patient being in control of it. But, you know, it's not 100%.
Yeah, interesting question. Looking at the biomarkers, starting with neuroimaging and MRIs in particular, you know, we talk about using an MRI to basically rule out strokes, tumor, any specific, you know, major vascular changes. What about using it to rule in Alzheimer's disease? Is that, how realistic is that? I mean, obviously, I know I've seen some clinicians will get volumetrics of the hippocampus and that area. You know, what do you do in your practice? And is this kind of a negative versus a positive biomarker in terms of making a decision whether someone may have Alzheimer's disease?
Well, in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, the MRI can be normal. So it's it's more of a rule out than a rule in. As the disease advances, of course, because of atrophy, you know, the brain shrinks, the fluid spaces enlarge, and it's no mystery. But very early in disease, it may be completely normal. Patients with Alzheimer's disease have more white matter hyperintensities on T2 weighted images than do people without it, but people with true vascular disease have even more. So that's not a rule in either.
How about FDG PET scans? Because we know there's a characteristic pattern. Do you make a diagnosis based on that, or is that just a piece of the puzzle that we need other data as well?
I think the only time that FDG PET scanning, and of course that's to measures the fractional uptake of glucose, so it measures brain metabolism. The only time I think that is really useful is when you have an atypical presentation. So in a patient who has a very typical presentation of Alzheimer's, I would say that's not a thing you would order. It's when the patient, you know, when you really, you know, is this Alzheimer's disease? Is it frontotemporal dementia? Is it Lewy body dementia? And you really can't figure this out clinically, that's when it can become useful. You know, in Alzheimer's disease, like the typical pattern is parietal, hypometabolism and frontotemporal dementia is, you know, frontal and medial temporal. And Lewy body, it's more occipital. So it can be an aid in a patient with an atypical presentation, but I wouldn't say it's indicated for the workup of every patient.
Elaine, do you have any tricks for especially more agitated demented patients in getting blood work done or even neuroimaging done? Because often that's a deal breaker, and I know a lot of primary care doctors will just pass than try to get someone who's having some behavioral manifestations more in-depth testing that they may need.
So for imaging, if you really need to get an image, you can sedate, you know, give the person a little lorazepam to sedate them. And usually that works to get them through an MRI scan. You know, MRI scans, they're a combination of, you know, if you have claustrophobia, it's a problem. It's, you know, it's a tight space. And also they're very loud. And I've had MRIs and I don't tolerate that sound very well. And, you know, first the foam earplugs and the silicone molded earplugs, then the headphones. And still, I find it not pleasant. And some people would do fine, but generally, a 0.25 or a half a milligram of lorazepam, if you need to get an image, will help the patient get through it.
Turning to PET scans. You know, we now have, I believe, three different amyloid imaging agents. I believe there's one tau imaging agent on the market now. Obviously, cost is a big issue. Steve, I know you've raised this issue quite a bit in terms of equity getting people. Should the gold standard be these scans versus, let's say, CSF analysis? What's your take on that? And what about in an era where, you know, there's both amyloid and tau scans? Is one better or worse than the other? And what about if people can't afford them at the end of the day?
So, the famous Cliff-Jack curve that shows when biomarkers show up versus when over the course of the disease. The very earliest biomarker that is positive in Alzheimer's disease is CSF A-beta-42. A reduction in CSF A-beta-42 is the very first one that happens. This is probably a few years ahead of being positive, meeting the threshold for positivity on an amyloid PET scan. And then after that comes CSF, tau, and even later, tau PET. So now we're getting better and better blood biomarkers, but CSF beta amyloid 42 remains sort of the gold standard. And there are now two FDA-approved CSF biomarker tests, the Alexis test that measures both p-tau 181, the ratio of p-tau 181 to amyloid, beta 42, and then the Fujirebio amyloid beta 42 over 40 ratio. So these are FDA-approved CSF biomarker tests. They're much cheaper than PET. My reading of PET is that it costs between $5,000 and $8,000. Steve, what have you found out about what the costs are?
It's in that range.
Yeah,
I know when we've tried to get people scanned, that's exactly what we're hearing.
Right.
You should run the $5,000 range.
And I'm running into out of pocket that it's not always covered, and that's often the deal breaker for families, because
Absolutely. The
question is, how is this going to help in the long run?
That's right.
And it's not just a question of cost. It's also scalability. So with the accelerated approval of several monoclonal antibodies for Alzheimer's disease, which require you to be amyloid positive to get treatment, this is going to be a huge, kind of scalability problem for the healthcare.
And on that point, I would say now we have blood-based biomarkers. So is that going to change the landscape? Because I will tell you, in terms of, I've been using in particular the amyloid-based ones, but I'm reluctant to make a diagnosis on that basis, and certainly more reluctant to use that on the basis for starting someone with anti-amyloid immunotherapy. So talk about, what's out, the different ones, and where you see them going.
So, blood-based biomarkers are the holy grails of biomarkers in Alzheimer's. And I've been a CSF biomarker researcher for about three decades. And I have to show you that I just had some base of thumb reconstructive surgery because of doing so many spinal taps for CSF biomarkers. So, we now have techniques for doing CSF collection that are extremely safe and acceptable for patients. So in our hands, the rate of post-LP headache using our, technique with a Sprott 24-gauge atraumatic spinal needle is 0.5%. So, we did a big study with over 400 consecutive spinal taps where we had people rate their pain and anxiety during the spinal tap. And the anxiety, pain is very low. Anxiety is a little higher. And our Alzheimer's patients, it's really a cognitive stressor. People, think about it and worry about it. The Alzheimer's patients have no pain, no anxiety. So it really is just the thinking about it. But if it's done correctly, it shouldn't hurt. I myself have had 5 epidural anesthesias, which are the same experience. It doesn't hurt. I'd rather do that than have my teeth cleaned. So it's really nothing, but it does take a skilled practitioner. And again, that's a matter of scalability. And you couldn't do it in a neurology practice, really. You'd have to have either a nurse practitioner in your office who was well-trained, or you'd have to have something like, the way they have infusion centers or places you go to have colonoscopy. They'd have to have a place where you go to get a spinal tap because it's just not doable in an office practice. So I think these are the real problems with both, PET imaging and CSF, are the ability to have this available and as you brought up, equity.
Are the new blood-based ones better in any way, or still, verdict is still out?
CSF. And their intent now, and I think this is before the approval, the FDA approval of several monoclonal antibodies to treat Alzheimer's. I think that's going to change the landscape, because the intent of either CSF or PET, of blood biomarkers has been to screen for people to get CSF or PET to confirm. But I think that's going to have to change because of the issues of scalability. It's going to be that blood biomarkers will be the acceptable mode of saying someone's amyloid positive.
Which ones do you think hold the most promise? I mean, I know that we can look at an amyloid 42 to 40 ratio in blood now with, I think, 2 of the tests. There's p-tau. We've used these in clinical trials. Some are on the market now. Do you use any of them, or which ones do you, what do you see unfolding in the next year or two?
Well, the Roche Elecsys amyloid blood test, which is approved, and it's in combination with A beta 42 to 40 ratio in combination with p-tau 181 and APOE genotype, and it is now has accelerated approval by the FDA. Fuji Rebio is falling close behind, and full disclosure, I have a collaboration with them to measure plasma biomarkers and our sample bank. So it will follow close behind. There are other CLIA certified, but not FDA approved studies. I think a very commonly used one is the C2N precipity test, which again is a combination of, it's the A beta 42 to 40 ratio plus p-tau 181 plus APOE genotype. And I'm sure it soon will get FDA approval as well. And then there are other healthcare institutions that have their own in-house CLIA certifiable or CLIA certified assays for blood biomarkers. And I firmly believe, despite my 30-year commitment and to CSF biomarkers, I firmly believe this is going to be the way of the future.
Interesting. Really a fascinating discussion of the range of these blood-based biomarkers. And I think the idea of combining them into one is also intriguing, because you're not chasing after 3 or 4 different tests. You get it all in one package. So we'll have to see how that unfolds.
But I think, you know, it bears mentioning, you know, Elaine has been trailblazing in this field.
Yeah,
and to have this conversation with her is just really special.
Yeah, and our way of saying thank you and our gratitude for bringing your, not just your expertise, but really your pioneering work in this field to this discussion.
And she gave her thumb for it.
That's right, and yeah, that's right.
The other thumb is going to have to be done eventually too, so.
Well, you more people need these, so you need to recuperate. So, but again, thank you for being part of this discussion and for your knowledge and wisdom here. And many people are going to benefit from this, so we appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You know, Steve, it's so important nowadays with these treatments on the horizon to be able to make an early diagnosis. And you highlighted many other reasons too. And I would say for so many families, it's the mystery of what's going on, and being able to detect this early can help solve that mystery and get them on a good pathway.
But totally exciting, right? This is in some ways brave new world of medicine, with more treatment options, but more detection options than we've ever had before. And, you know, I think Dr. Peskin's absolutely correct. Someone who's skilled, like you, who in being able to make the diagnosis, there's a very high reliability on that diagnosis. But we know that the availability of geriatric psychiatrists, of neurologists, you know, if you're in an urban center, much easier. If you're in a rural location, you're really relying on the primary care doctor. And these are critical tools in sure. being able to unravel that mystery for untold numbers of families.
So here's a double-edged sword. Someone goes into their primary care, they run this blood test, the results come back, and they say, you got Alzheimer's disease. They're not meeting with an expert, they don't have the benefit, all the resources yet. So to some extent, it gives them all the information they need, to get them on a pathway, but you and I both know people need an enormous amount of support and guidance from the get-go. Do you think this is going to derail some of that?
Or create an opportunity. I mean, maybe this is the direction telemedicine goes for geriatric psychiatry and neurology in providing support to people who really don't have the accessibility today. Maybe that would be a beneficial outcome of the pandemic and really the explosion of telehealth services.
I think that's a good point. So in essence, what we've covered is the fact that early diagnosis is critical. We have many new treatments coming in the pike, and so people need to know early because they want to get treatment early. We have a variety of biomarkers now we can look to. There are expense issues, equity issues, obviously, but that may be solved for with better blood-based tests, which will be more accessible. We don't have thousands of Dr. Peskins who are experts at spinal taps, and so if you can draw blood and do it, that will be better. And it's going to usher into this era, as we've been talking about through these programs, where individuals with Alzheimer's disease and ideally with other neurocognitive disorders are getting readily diagnosed and treated and getting them on a better pathway and eventually to a cure for this disease.
Totally agree. And I think the other thing that we're subtly talking about, but I think bears underscoring, is we're seeing the beginning of the end of the helplessness
yes.
of this diagnosis.
That's such a good point, and I want to end on that point because it's a point of hope and one that will take us into the future. So, Steve, it's always a pleasure having this discussion with you. Thank you for your wisdom and thoughts on this, and looking forward to future discussions.
Thank you. Looking forward as well.